River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This winter, two stories gained national attention regarding brain-dead pregnant women and their unborn children. In one case, the husband kept his wife on life support until the baby was born. And in the other, a husband fought to take his wife off of life support. And we want to use these and other cases as a jumping-off point to focus our hour on medical ethics after these recent cases. And to a certain degree, having sparked a national conversation about brain death, also levels of brain functioning. How do we decide in such cases what is the right or the good thing to do? Who makes these decisions? And these are all questions none of us hope we ever have to answer, but unfortunately, some of us do in the course of our lifetimes. Let's start off by taking a look at these cases through the eyes of some medical professionals we've invited into our conversation today. Later in the program, we'll talk with an Iowa mother who has faced some very tough decisions. She faced them when she lost her son last year in an accident. But first of all, let me introduce our first two guests. Loris Kaljan is the physician ethicist and director of the program in bioethics and humanities at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Loris Kaljan, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Carl Thomas returns to our studio with us a few weeks ago to talk about e-cigarettes. Dr. Thomas is the executive vice chair for clinical programs, clinical professor of internal medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Thomas, welcome back to you.
It's a pleasure to be back, Ben.
If I can turn to you, Loris Kaljan, to explain these cases a little more than the brief description that I gave and highlight what ethical questions they bring to the fore.
You know, the first thing to say is that they both involved remarkably tragic situations, and we all shudder to think of what it would be like to have a loved one to go through such a trauma, and then to think about the responsibility on the shoulders of those who have to make decisions for the rest or end of their lives. And then add to that to think of the phenomenon of pregnancy in this sort of tragic setting. So one first is almost, shall we say, silenced in a humble sort of way to realize how dangerous it is to talk about other people's lives in this way. Having said that, as a medical professional myself, we all know that part of being a professional is that we literally do have to speak with other people. And so that's not only a license but a responsibility to do that. And these cases really raise a phenomenal number of phenomenal questions. And the first that we're talking about today is this notion of brain death. And it raises questions of death generally and how is death defined. And brain death, as we'll be talking about, is something that in one sense is a routine diagnosis, but in another sense, I believe, has not been routinized because it still is both controversial as well as in some cases confusing for people in our society. These cases also raise questions about how decisions are made at the end of life, generally speaking, when decisions are made to either withhold life-sustaining treatment or to withdraw it after it's begun. And then a key question that these cases both gave evidence to was a question of who gets to decide. One question is, what is the good and right thing to do? Another question is, well, who gets to decide if all the parties involved can't agree on what the good or right thing to do is? And then we can also, you know, raise the very important questions about what the significance of pregnancy is in this context when you have another human being, in this case a fetus, inside of a woman who has been diagnosed with a devastating neurological injury. And what do we as citizens and as professionals and as a society make of that? And the last thing I would just say to begin is that for me, these situations raise great questions about what shared decision-making really is when loved ones, nurses, doctors, and other professionals in the hospital really come together and try to decide what is best for all concerned and what is the kind of dialogue that is needed so that people are speaking and listening and walking forward together in these very complicated and emotionally and spiritually demanding situations.
Loris, let's start with your first point there about brain death. Give us a little bit of a sense of the history of brain death in the context of other types of death that are spoken of in medicine.
So traditionally, of course, death was understood when basically the heart and the lungs were no longer doing what they're supposed to do to keep the blood flowing through the human body. In the 1960s, the term brain death was introduced, and there were various committees that were formed to basically come up with a new idea of a definition of death, and that was termed brain death. And I would say that it's controversial even to this day, such that some people don't, within the medical professions, they don't even recommend using the term brain death.
What is the point of controversy that strikes the chord there?
Because for some people, it's hard intuitively or otherwise to believe that the death of one organ, granted a very special organ, the brain, that the death of one organ equals the death of the whole human being in a given case. People at the bedside, you could imagine, if this is your loved one you're talking about, their body is warm. You see their chest rising and falling as the breathing machine is helping their lungs breathe. You look at that person who you know, and then the doctor says your loved one is dead. You can even start to wonder even the complexities of now, do we refer to that loved one as a person or as a body, or what do we understand that to be? So the controversies of what brain death really means are very real, I think, for people who face these situations, but even for some professionals who would prefer to take a traditional lung and heart definition of death.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Thomas, tell us at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, how often are such cases? We had the cases of pregnant women mm-hmm. being brain dead, but certainly there are all kinds of variations without a pregnancy being involved, for instance. How often are those types of decisions, do they have to be made, the points worked through by families?
Yeah, Ben, I think that's a great question. And I think the most important thing is that the cases of the two tragic pregnant women are relatively rare. And fortunately for us, they're very rare because they're also really hard to work through. But what's most common are really patients who have had some medical diseases, or maybe they've had some catastrophic trauma. And we have to make decisions about continuing the sort of invasive treatments that we're doing with breathing machines or with special pumps to the heart, or with keeping them alive even though they don't have any reflexes, they don't respond to anyone, like they're in a coma. Those are decisions that we face almost every day in our critical care units. One of the things to remember with all of this is while the cases that grab national media attention and that we see and that really spark a lot of those critical questions are actually things that unfortunately families and doctors and nurses and social workers have to deal with on almost an everyday basis in intensive care units and in hospitals and nursing homes.
In just a moment, we'll be talking with an Iowa mother who faced very tough decisions when she lost her son last year in an accident. And we're very grateful that she's willing to come forward and talk about a very painful chapter in her life just a year ago, that accident happening. I want to reach out to our listeners this hour and ask you if you or someone in your family have ever faced a medical emergency, a situation where there were some tough decisions involved, a situation where you may have struggled to find the appropriate, the right, ethical, the good choice. Or also, we entertain any questions about medical ethics this hour. 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Before we add a couple of other guests here, I would like to have you give us an idea of how what is the framework that you use to approach questions of life support when it may appear the person is breathing, perhaps a respirator is being used in cases of brain death, perhaps there is some significant part of that person that is not no longer there or will not ever return to that person. How do you approach that those types of dilemmas?
Let me start with that.
Dr. Thomas, yeah.
The most important thing in just starting is to not jump to too many conclusions in the beginning and not to make too many assumptions. And And by what I mean by that is really that we need to understand how the patient got there. What was the actual disease, or what was the actual trauma, or what was the thing that actually resulted in that patient having come into the hospital to begin with? Because the medical condition and the medical issues of the patient are primarily the driver for what is likely to happen in the future. And so there are illnesses which we fully expect to be reversible. There are illnesses which can be treated. And on the flip side, there are other things which we no longer have the ability to treat, but really we're taking the patient and taking the family and really taking our staff through the process of dying. And sometimes that involves things like mechanical ventilators, and sometimes it involves some pretty specialized stuff with cardiopulmonary resuscitation and things like that. And sometimes it's really the time to back off, or the time to talk about the comfort or the goals of the patient. So if the patient has a sudden and catastrophic illness that's treatable, that's a very different conversation and a very different situation than someone who may have a diagnosis that we know will ultimately take their life and may be causing tremendous pain.
You know, part of making any good decision is certainly first knowing what the facts are. And one of the great challenges in medicine is sometimes we don't know what the facts are. And so if we don't know what a diagnosis is yet, or don't know what the prognosis is, the it that we're talking about remains a question mark to some degree. Once we think we have a sufficient handle, or at least the best we're going to have at that moment, then we have to go forward. And then one of the key things that we need is some kind of an ethical framework, which is a very big question for all of us. We teach medical ethics in our hospitals and our medical schools, and yet we also know in a morally pluralistic society, and by that I mean a society where we have different places each one of us are coming from to some degree, even though thankfully in our hospitals there's a lot of overlap in terms of the values and goods that we're pursuing together. But Dr. Thomas mentioned this word goals and goals of care, and that's key to the best kind of decision-making, I would suggest. In fact, all good human decision-making is goal-oriented, I would like to offer. And so it's really important to decide with patients what the proper or most important goals of care should be in a given case, whether it be, say, to prolong someone's life versus to keep them comfortable versus both. Those questions come up. But also we talk a lot about probabilities. What are the odds that we think we will get to our goal with a given intervention? And then a third dimension beyond goals and probabilities, I would add, would be how much suffering is someone willing to go through to get to that goal on that probability.
Mm-hmm. We've had up to this point a very scientifically based conversation with goals, establishing the facts of the matter. But I know in this we have a dimension that deals with philosophy, with religious beliefs. This in a clinical decision-making setting, how is that dealt with when we're talking about the end of life? We may believe a soul leaves a body at a certain point. How is that world, that non-scientific world, dealt with in decision-making? And in some families, many families, I have to believe, this is a very important component.
This is a great question, and some people would suggest that there are sort of two main camps within this realm in terms of how we even look at persons and talk about personhood. Some would take a view that says that awareness and the ability to reason are fundamental to a person, and especially once someone believes that consciousness is no longer possible, that there's no longer a person there. Others say, taking the view of the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, would talk about an ensouled body or an embodied soul. And the integration of the body and the soul is the fundamental reality of what it is to be a human person. So I think there are very contrasting domains in this regard. One example of this, which is very concrete and relevant to today's discussion, it comes from the state of New Jersey. That's an example of a state that in its law allows for a religious exception to the usual definition of death as being either based on the heart or based on brain death. And it was driven, to my understanding, by the Orthodox Jewish community that wanted to be able to use a heart-based, circulatory-based definition of death as being the definition that they will act upon. So that's a very nice example of how our society in one state has accommodated that specific religious perspective.
What are the laws like in Iowa? We looked at the national attention given to the first two cases that I mentioned. You mentioned another case here. What are the hallmarks of Iowa's cases? Does it differ greatly from other states?
No, Iowa is relatively similar in the regard to statutes regarding brain death. There is something called the Uniform Determination of Death Act, and the Iowa law is patterned very much after that. That allows for not only death by definition of not breathing or death by definition of no heart rate, but also death by definition of no recoverable brain function. And so there are, and Iowa law is very similar to many other states in that regard.
Okay. I'd like to bring in a couple more of our guests before we go to a break in a few minutes. Sue Witte is with us in our Iowa City studio, social worker at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Sue, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
You also sit on the Ethics Committee at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and you do a lot of work organizing organ and tissue donations. There's an aspect we haven't talked about quite yet, the linkage of brain death to donors, but of tissues and organs. Also with us, joining us by phone, Tiffany Brockway, a Burlington resident. Hi, Tiffany.
Hello.
Your 10-year-old son, Garrett, was involved in an accident almost exactly a year ago, February 24th of 2013, while working on some family property with his father. Garrett was struck by a falling tree, I understand.
Yes, that's correct.
Only a year has gone by. I'm flabbergasted and awed by the fact that you will take part in this conversation, and I know it's to a great end because you formed the Garrett M. Brockway Foundation to raise awareness for organ donation. But let me just start off by saying we're very sorry for your family's loss and very grateful for you sharing your experience this hour.
Well, thank you. We appreciate the opportunity. Through our situation, you know, because of what happened with Garrett and his devastating neurological injury, we were pretty quickly faced after a couple days with the possibility. The neurosurgeon team came in probably 48 hours after arriving up at U of I PICU floor that, you know, his injuries were just too severe for him to survive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, up to that point, you know, my husband, Bruce, and I, we had all the hope in the world that he was going to be able to overcome and recover from his injuries. We absolutely and certainly prayed for a miracle. Our community was supporting us, and even people throughout the entire country were supporting us and praying. But when the team of neurosurgeons came in and gave us that news.
What news precisely?
They basically said, you know, we're sorry to tell you that your son's injuries are too severe, and it's very unlikely that he will survive this event. And at that time, I looked over to Bruce, and I said, I need to speak with you in private. There were approximately 16 doctors, neurosurgeon doctors in the room. And so Bruce and I went into a private room, and, you know, I've always been an advocate of organ donation since the day I had my permit and got my driver's license at 16. I've always been a registered donor. And, you know, my husband and I, we never, ever had a conversation up to that point. You know, what if this would happen to Garrett or our daughter Adeline? We, you know, of course, that's not a conversation that any family wants to have. But as soon as the doctor shared that news with us, I immediately knew that, you know, he was so healthy and physically fit that if he wasn't going to be able to survive, that we could help families that were in our very similar situation, mm-hmm. you know, keep their loved ones and give their loved ones another chance.
Would you mind sharing what that first conversation with Bruce, the father, was? What was like? Was
sure.
it that immediate to reach that conclusion, or did you? What were the struggles along the way?
You know, it was. We've talked about it. We can't really explain it. We both. He said that, you know, when the neurosurgeons told us that news, that he thought the same thing, and he wasn't sure how he was going to approach me, because in a way it felt like we were giving up on Garrett, you know, and he didn't want to talk to me about it. But when we went in that room and I said, you know, I think we have to think about organ donation, he just nodded his head and he said, I agree. And so at that point, we asked to speak with someone about organ donation. And at that time, Sue Whitty showed up relatively soon, and she just started talking to us about what happens and, you know, if there's brain death, that you can donate the heart, and if there's not brain death, you know, the heart is not an option. And we, you know, we were just like, what? We're going to have to leave him with his beating heart? You know, I guess we hadn't thought that through. And so we just said, you know, she gave us all the facts, all the information. And then we just said, you know what, we need to talk to our priest, because we weren't sure how our church felt about, you know, donating and doing this organ donation with his heart beating. Yes, mm-hmm. We weren't sure he was brain dead yet. We hadn't gone through those phases, those tests yet. But we just, you know, we had questions that we needed answered. And so we reached out to our priest, and they came back and said that, you know, all religions support it. And if your child or your loved one is being kept, their life is being sustained by machines, then it's okay. It's not a form of, you know, taking the life unnecessarily.
Tiffany Brockway, before we have a couple minutes before a break, I want to have mm-hmm. Sue Whitty comment on this. Your recollection of this case, you organize organ and tissue donations at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. You're on the ethics committee there. What did this case present to you?
Well, it was overwhelmingly sad to meet the Brockways under those circumstances. But I think we had talked earlier, Dr. Calhoun talked earlier about the responsibility that we have to provide information to families when they're making end-of-life decisions. And one of those is donation. And so my job at the university is to ensure that families are given all of their options. And what families need most at that time in their lives is information. And the doctors are providing the medical information about brain death, about non-survivability. And it's a team effort as far as providing that information about what all their options are and decisions that they have to make.
Okay, we have to take a short break. We'll come back with Sue Whitty, Tiffany Brockway, Dr. Loris Calhoun, and also Dr. Carl Thomas. We're talking about medical ethics, specifically more focused on brain death, a couple of cases nationally, and also we're grateful to have Tiffany Brockway, having suffered a tragedy recently, to talk about that. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a few minutes. Back with more of River to River. From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow, a Friday News Buzz edition of our program, we'll check in again with Des Moines Register sports columnist Bryce Miller. He's in Sochi, Russia. He's covered six Olympics. And one of the things we'll talk about is what stands out for him about this Olympics. Certainly, the less-than-ideal weather for many of the skiers will be one point I know he'll mention. Also, funnel week at the legislature. Joyce Russell will tell us which bills made it and which didn't. Plenty of other things you'll want to tune in for tomorrow over the noon hour, a News Buzz edition of River to River. Today, we're focusing on medical ethics after recent cases have sparked sort of a national conversation about brain death, levels of brain functioning. How to decide what is the right or good thing to do, the ethical thing to do, when presented with unexpected tragedies in life? Who makes these decisions? And trying to prepare ourselves for that unhappy eventuality. We want to talk about this half hour. Joining us, we have with us Dr. Loris Calhoun, physician ethicist and director of the program in bioethics and humanities at the University of Iowa. Dr. Carl Thomas, executive vice chair for clinical programs and clinical professor of internal medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Also, Sue Whitty is a social worker at the UIHC. sits on the Ethics Committee. And Tiffany Brockway joins us by phone, a resident. And Tiffany is sharing the story of organ donation. Her 10-year-old son, Garrett, involved in an accident almost exactly a year ago in February of 2013. And she and her husband, Bruce, decided that organ donation was the right choice in this case. In fact, they formed the Garrett M. Brockway Foundation to raise awareness about organ donation. Let's pick up the story there with you, Tiffany, if I could. You talked about last half hour how the decision you and your husband made about organ donation was reached. Tell us, when you made that decision, what ended up being the benefits of being able to help Garrett benefit other children?
So after we initially talked with Sue and she gave us the factual information that we needed, like she had earlier stated, we did a lot of talking with each other, consulting with our priests, and then just letting things take their course to see what was going to happen with Garrett's medical condition. Over the course of the next 24 hours, we did get a clinical diagnosis of brain death, and there we were a part of and watched the three different tests that they did by different medical staff, so that there's no bias or question of a false result. And so once he was declared brain dead on Wednesday, February 27th. During that time, we had already told Organ Donation, Iowa Donor Network, and Sue Whitty that we were going to probably proceed with organ donation. And the key thing was going to be the brain death, because we would be able to donate his heart. And so as things turned out, he was determined to be medically brain dead as a result of his main artery and his brain being severed. And so once that happened, then Iowa Donor Network did their part in procuring all of the organs to the recipients, and we stayed by his side until he was taken to OR, and we walked him as far as we could and said our goodbyes to him. But the only thing I will say is, it's an absolutely horrific, tragic event, and nobody wants this to happen, especially a parent, especially a mother. You want to do everything you can to protect your children and keep them alive. But when it comes to that point that they can't, you think of the other mothers and other families out there that they are hoping for that gift. And so that Thursday, that next day, we left that hospital with our heads held very high, because we knew that so many families were benefiting. He donated his heart, his liver, both of his kidneys, his pancreas, both of his corneas and tissue, and so many people have benefited from him.
I understand 5 lives saved and many, many others whose lives were improved. Tell me, what is the role of that knowledge? It must be tremendous in not getting past the grief, but how does that fit in with your grieving to improve it at least a little?
It absolutely improves it. I mean, it's been, organ donation has been the bright light in our lives this past year. Hearing from his recipients, we've heard from 7 of them already. We've been very blessed to hear from 7 of them. And we've met Leslie, his pancreas recipient. We hope to meet more of them. But it's an absolutely bright light, because we know that through his gifts, other families are enjoying their loved ones. And because of it, we've just become very passionate about organ donation. The staff at Iowa Donor Network has been, I can't even speak highly enough of them. Sue Whitty has become a very close friend of our family. It's not just a job for her. It's her life. And, they care for not only the donors, but the donors' families. And Iowa Donor Network is just, it's been such an important partner with us, and companions and friends. Some of them, we like Sue, we feel are almost family to us. But it's Bruce and I, we want to create as much awareness for organ donations so that families can talk about it ahead of time, so that if they are faced with the situation like Bruce and I unfortunately were, that they have already had those difficult conversations and they can be a united front at that time.
Let's use that as a point to jumping off. How do we prepare? None of us know what will happen this week, next month, and so forth. So these are rare occurrences, fairly rare occurrences, fortunately. How should each one of us prepare for the potential of being caught in such a situation? Sue Whitty.
Well, I think it's just so important. You know, it's like Tiffany said, you know, you really don't think of, you know, try not to go down that path of contemplating your child's death or your spouse's death. But it's so important to really plan ahead and have that conversation before you're in the midst of a tragedy like the Brockways were, to talk about if you were neurologically devastated what interventions, how far would you want your decision maker to go? And again, if you would be interested in saving lives through donation. So I think it's a great conversation to have before you're faced with something terrible.
Dr. Thomas.
I'd like to add that it's very hard for even us physicians who work in the ICU to know exactly what's in the future or what's in store. But one of the common things that we see is that there's, you know, at the point when people are really, really struggling or very desperately ill, there's almost always some kind of technology, some kind of pump, whether it's a feeding pump or a breathing pump or a heart pump. And those are technically challenging, and we spend a lot of years training on how to learn how to use them. But for people out there and for people who are the patients and their families, it's very hard to think about those things because they've never seen them. But one of the things I think is really important is just to start thinking about, well, what are our values? What are the things that we think are the most important and make our lives rich and make our lives full?
And you can express those to your loved ones in a directive, Dr. Kaljan. Talk about that. And a term that pops up here is something called the dead donor rule. How does that fit into our conversation?
If I can just say, just before going on to the dead donor rule, on this question of these advanced directives, some of our listeners will recognize those as the so-called living will. You can go to the Iowa Bar Association's website and actually download a copy of a living will. There is even a section that pertains to organ donation on there as well, if I recall that correctly. The point I just want to make right now is that those tools, they're pieces of paper that are signed, and they also can be used to appoint someone who will be your decision maker if that's also something that you want in a specific legally authorized way. The benefits of those documents is that they give some information, but they actually cannot, in almost all cases, predict the actual circumstances that individuals may find themselves in the future. And so this is why you heard Dr. Thomas mm-hmm. talk about the patient's or family's values and their beliefs and how important those are to help guide what specific interventions should or shouldn't be used. Because sometimes there's the temptation to have a checkbox where I'd like this, but I wouldn't like that. Mm-hmm. And you go down and talk about interventions, but you don't know until you know the reality on the ground which interventions make sense or not.
When we have these family values, but we also have state laws, federal laws, what happens when those come into conflict? They did in these national cases that received attention.
Well, and then so the question of who gets to decide. And I'm always grateful that we live in a democracy where we hammer out together how we should play fair and how to have due process and what makes sense to appoint certain people like family members as the most appropriate decision makers. But having said that, we're also grateful to live in a society where the law sometimes does make statements about boundaries and says that we take such great interest in human life that we want to protect it, especially when patients could not be more vulnerable because they cannot speak for themselves.
Sue Whitty, you've dealt with numerous cases of brain death and leading to organ donation. This one described by Tiffany, the Brockways there, was made easier in the sense, it sounds like, because it was a clear-cut case. of brain death. Are cases in much more of a gray area that you've dealt with?
Well, I know we talked earlier about the percentage of patients who become brain dead, and really it's 1% of death is brain death. And so we certainly see more of the patients who don't have that clear-cut criteria of brain death but have a neurological injury. And we were talking about values, and that's so important because that is what guides. You know, I had a case just this week of a gentleman who had a fall and was devastated from the fall to a brain injury. And the family said if he can't golf and he can't be in his garden, he wouldn't want to survive. And so it's really knowing what it is that's important. Some people would say, well, no, I that's not really important to me if I could be with my children.
Right.
And so you really have to know and let people know what it is.
But Dr. Kaljan, we can make a statement when we're healthy and alive and then have a trauma happen to us, and then we can be faced with a situation. And that directive, we look at it in a different way often, don't we?
And that's actually been shown in actual studies where many people will change their minds once they come closer to those possibilities in the future. I think we all need a certain modesty and humility about these things. Yes, to be responsible, and to the extent that we can try to express things and help other people make decisions around us and for us, that's all well and good. But we also have to reckon with the unknown futures before each one of us. And what many people find most valuable in all this is to make sure that they will be surrounded by or accompanied by someone they can trust to make decisions that will respect their dignity as human beings.
You're nodding your head vigorously, Dr. Thomas.
Yeah. And I'd like to continue with that idea, which is that very often in the intensive care unit, as a physician and as a caregiver and as a member of a healthcare team, we look at our patients, and often we can predict what's in their future. But in many cases, it comes down to a very concrete conversation about a tube for a breathing machine or a tube for feeding or a dialysis machine. And it is a very different scenario where the patient has a very strong advocate and someone who really understands what this person would have wanted. Would they want to live like this, or would they want to move on in this situation? And really what their goals were.
And that helps you as a physician.
Tremendously. Mm-hmm. It's the most important thing in coming to a good resolution for many of these cases.
How often as a physician do you run into the case where you present the facts to the family and they arrive at a polar opposite conclusion than you think the facts point to? What do you do in that case?
Well, in that case, we try to take as many perspectives as possible and really begin a process of reviewing the patient's life and what we know about their religious beliefs and what we know about their family beliefs. We engage the family as much as possible. And then we have so many people in the hospital who help us out, other team members, our chaplains. Sue Witte and I have worked together on several difficult cases. And when we have an ethics group as well that we work with when the difficulties are really almost insurmountable. And often sometimes they can't be resolved, and we can turn to the law as well as another source of guidance in these cases.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes in that case, does the law then, as you prescribed, that there are boundaries, the law trumps family wishes in some cases?
I think when it comes down to things like particularly pediatric cases, and the unborn, those are critical issues where I do think that we have to pay attention to the idea that the state has a vested interest in protecting all individuals and speaking for those who cannot speak for themselves.
We have about 5 minutes left of our conversation. Perhaps we can look forward to I want to get your views on where you see this area changing in the future. What changes are upon us right now, which we will see increasing? And what ones perhaps we can't even imagine yet in the future.
You know, before you mentioned dead donor rule, and now
yes,
I'll respectfully
back
come
quickly.
Back to that, because that it does raise one of these sort of cutting edge questions. So by federal law, unless somebody is donating, say, a kidney as a living donor, we're not talking about that right now, but any other organ procurement can only be done after a human being has been declared dead. And so people who look at the history of the notion of brain death look to the 1960s when they saw that we needed, they thought, that society needed this new definition of death to justify taking organs from a human being whose heart was still beating. Some people now are raising the question, I'm not saying I am, but some people are raising the question, do we have to stick with this dead donor rule? Why can't, if say if somebody who's about to have life support disconnected, if they say to the doctor, doctor, before you disconnect it, take me to the operating room, put me under general anesthesia, and take my kidneys, for instance, and then you can let me die. Society right now says we don't do that.
Do you think we're moving in that direction?
I'm not sure, but maybe Dr. Thomas would like to comment on that.
I think that the questions are going to become more and more frequent. And you had asked, you know, what does the future hold? And I think what the future holds is a lot more technology that will allow organs to function or to support failing organs. And this technology is going to be smaller. It's going to be more portable. And it's going to work much, much better. So even now in our own intensive care units, we have machines that can remove carbon dioxide and put oxygen into the blood. We have very small machines that are heart pumps. And the question that Loris brings up, and particularly with respect to donation, is, well, if those machines are continuing to function and the patient continues to decline, what should we do if we just have to flip a switch to turn it off and that is the moment of death? And it's not just a mechanical ventilator anymore. It's these miniaturized machines that are becoming pervasive.
Sue Whitty.
Right. I think we get better at managing chronic illness and offering organ transplantation to those patients who are sick and have different equipment on them, but our donor pool remains stagnant. So we're looking at ways constantly on how to offer more transplants to patients, although even, you know, only 1% of our patients are dying from brain death. So I think we have a lot of pressure on how to increase donation and the ethics around that.
On this technology question, I wonder, does technology have the ability to change our definition of death? Will that change in the future? Will we not know what is the point of death in certain cases?
I would suggest that the definition of death will not be a scientific or technological question. It will be a fundamentally human question, and we as citizens and as professionals are going to continue to struggle with that.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to Tiffany on the line. What have been your thoughts as we finish up this program, Tiffany Brockway?
You know, we could go on and on and on talking about this. Like we're saying, every situation is different. Everybody's values and ethics are different. And all that I can do personally is to just do my best to promote organ donation awareness because I absolutely, truly believe in it. I see the value of it. And when we were in that situation, we knew that we could have kept Garrett on machines for a very long time. But our personal values and ethics were that he wasn't the Garrett that we knew, and he was never going to wake up. He was never going to breathe on his own. He was never going to talk. And so we spend our lives now obviously remembering him, but doing our very best to create awareness for organ donation.
10-year-old, your 10-year-old son, Garrett, died in February of 2013. And tell us how we can find out more information about the foundation you formed, the Garrett M. Brockway Foundation, to raise awareness for organ donation before we close here.
Well, we have a website. It's actually called Garrett's Path. It was originated off of a poem that my husband, Bruce, wrote. So you can go to Garrett's Path. GarrettsPath.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're just doing our best to keep, you know, our events posted, and we're giving back. We're doing a lot of things to honor our son, and we're doing scholarships. We were able to hold a 5K last September, and we donated some of the proceeds to Iowa Donor Network. We're giving automatic defibrillators to the Little League Diamonds. We're doing a lot of wonderful things.
Check out that website, Tiffany. We have to go. Thank you so much again for taking part and raising our awareness about organ donation. I want to thank our other guests, Dr. Loris Kaljan, of the University of Iowa, Dr. Carl Thomas, as well, and Sue Witte, all of the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. So much to talk about here. We didn't get to the half of it here in the hour, but I appreciate you coming in to talk about it. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on our program, a NewsBuzz edition. Again, we'll check in with Register sports columnist, Des Moines Register sports columnist Bryce Miller. He's in Sochi. Find out what his experience has been like since the last time we talked with him at the opening of the Olympics. Also, funnel week at the legislature. Joyce Russell will tell us what made it and what different didn't. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.